I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one's the last roundup of memorable voices at the Calabash Literary Festival in Jamaica. I come to a gathering like this for two big reasons. One is to hear Caribbean writers at home, even the ones who've become famous in America, like Juno Diaz and Edwige Dontica, sound different, maybe deeper, in the islands of Bob Marley and Derek Walcott. The second mission for me is to see the States from a penetrating gaze just offshore. It's always on my mind that Jamaican artists observe us Americans as knowingly as Ireland's famous writers watch the world of the British Empire. So, as the Calabash talk winds down, I'm gathering up conversations with Jamaicans and visitors from all over about the U.S. and the world early in the age of Obama. The impressions here are from the breakthrough filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles, the Hong Kong novelist Su Shi, the repeat poet laureate of the United States, Robert Pinsky, and the world citizen and poet Kwame Dawes. Van Peebles came to Calabash to show his new movie, Confessions of an Ex-Doofus, Itchy-Footed Mother, nearly 40 years after he inaugurated the black feature film tradition with Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. With me, Melvin Van Peebles is just short of exultant about the direction of things at home.
I think the States is on the right track, oddly enough. Things are coming to fruition. I remember for the election, Mario and myself were making telephone calls all around for Obama, etc., etc. And then I went to a swing party on Central Park on West, and there was a television set, and it kept saying Obama was ahead, and I knew somebody was messing with the set. So toward the end, I just couldn't take it any longer. I got up and left the party. And the cab driver came to pick me up, and I got in the cab, and when we got to my apartment, the guy would not take any money. He says, "We won, man. We won. And it was a guy from Sri Lanka. He said, and he's saying, and he wouldn't take money. When a New York cab driver will not take money from me, then I said, well, hey, maybe things are changing. It was really a seminal moment in my life. I could not believe it when I woke up the next morning. He was still the elected president. Wow. That was my take on the whole thing. You just keep pushing, you keep pushing, you keep pushing, you keep pushing. I don't look up, because if I look up, I still see how far I got to go or how to do. You remember that song used to be, "High Ho, it got high ho." And it was like another rubber tree plant. There goes, whoops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
That was Sinatra's song for JFK in 1960.
It was?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah, that's
he remade it for JFK.
Really, really. Well,
so we'll back Jack or something
Like
that. And what do you see so far? What do you see that you like, or do you have reservations?
I have no reservations so far because I don't know the details, but the overall, I like it. Not a little, I like it a lot. The fact that he is there, he has not done anything super stupid, has it's difficult for, say, for the intelligentsia or the enlightened people to understand how enormously important that is already, because people just assume, well, this couldn't happen. I remember when I used to be a navigator on jet bombers, and they just integrated the service, and the guys would come and they would talk to me. Says, I used to be president, but I saw your fingers working at radar just like a white boy, them black fingers of yours. People, we overlook the degree of stupidity that people have. America hasn't blown up. I mean, that's already a revelation. That's broken every mold already. The longer, the better. Things will never be the same. Just at that point there, okay, that's already four home runs.
Something in our country has changed so fundamentally, it's almost impossible to describe, but you feel it everywhere. Do you feel it?
Well, actually, I feel more of a change when I went to France recently. I was home there, and they were more excited. The elections, you see, we as Americans are happy, but we don't analyze the fundamentals that it can never go back. I mean, the guy is not messing up. You may not like some little molecule of this, that, and the other, but he sure doesn't give fodder to the stereotype of how a person of African descent can't get his find his way out of the cotton patch. Do you know what I mean? So that's changed. Boom, we can't. The question ain't over out can't be discussed anymore. Huh? And that's an immense change. That's an immense change from the very virulent racist and aside from the more liberal people. Wow. It ain't going to go back. You can't go back there.
Melvin Ben Peoples, it's a great pleasure to see you in Jamaica, to hear you and to gab with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Sushi is a literary light of a changing Hong Kong view. She's both novelist and essayist, minding the gap, so to speak, between Hong Kong, the British colony for a century, and now China's booming gateway for all kinds of commerce and cultural traffic east and west. Sushi, I come to Jamaica to see the United States from offshore. What do you see about the U.S. of A. from this kind of near but very familiar penetrating distance?
Well, the thing that is interesting since Obama's taken office is the shift I've seen, especially in Hong Kong, among friends who were always dissing America, you know, British friends, Australian friends, Chinese friends, who are suddenly sort of so much more, you know, sympathetic towards America. It's like, oh, well, the U.S. of A. isn't all that bad. There were times I felt sort of almost I had to keep my Americanness quiet because I am a citizen of the country and I have these sort of sense of a sort of like, well, where do my loyalties lie, you know? Because I'm also Chinese as well, and you don't ever lose that either. And I'm also Hong Kong, again, something I don't lose. But I think it's interesting how the image of America has changed, or at least shifted. And it's perceptibly, you know, you can see it in the way people talk about America. It's much kinder these days. In fact, I'm thinking of one British friend of mine who's a dear friend and a very smart man who has never been to the U.S. And never actually had a great desire to go, but at this point is now expressing a desire to go ever since Obama took office. And I think, good, I hope he does, because he's the kind of person who really should come and take a look, you know.
Did we change? Did we just go so far the other way that we had to come back? When they ask you, what about that other country of yours? What do you tell them?
I don't think America has changed fundamentally. I mean, it's still the same country it always was. But I think the thing that I think one of the things that I find that certainly Chinese friends and overseas friends that I encounter do not understand is that they do not understand the way democracy functions in America. It's like, okay, so you have this president that people are getting tired of. Well, you know, his term is only 4 years and you can replace him. This is the thing about term limits I really like. And the president is not America, which sometimes, of course, I mean, with a large country like the U.S., a superpower, it's hard to remember that. And it's too easy to just say, well, television is America, you know, MTV is America, Hollywood is America, Bush is America as opposed to Obama is America. No one thing really contains America. America is too large a thing unto itself. And that, I think that's the thing that people forget. And the thing about American democracy I really like is that when you need to speak, then you do. Otherwise, it's like, why vote? Things are going fine. Okay, so, you know, you have a majority voting, but it's not a huge majority. But all of a sudden, when things aren't so fine, people will come out and vote with their feet. You know, that's what happens. It's like, okay, we don't like it, we'll come out and we'll vote and we'll take care of things. We'll change it.
It's been said that unless the West does something almost miraculous with its economic recovery, China wins. It's got the cash, it's got the manufacturing, it's got a market that it hasn't even begun to sell to. How is China preparing for a much, much bigger place in the world?
Well, it's making a lot of friends. It's going around to places like Venezuela, for example.
Brazil.
Brazil, exactly. It's even making nice with Taiwan these days, which is a good thing. We'd rather see that than them not make nice with Taiwan. But I think a few things. One certainly is the cultural influence, the sort of soft power thing, you know, the Confucius Institutes that are springing up around different parts of the world. The fact that Chinese, the teaching of Chinese is widely encouraged. And it's a surprising thing. You know, you wander around Beijing or you wander around Hong Kong or Shanghai, there are hundreds of these young foreigners of every stripe, you know, they come from Europe, they come from America, they come from Australia, Britain, whatever, who are all sort of jabbering in Chinese and teaching English, perhaps, or doing whatever they do there, or traveling. But there
we think of that as a one-way street. They learn English, and we still don't learn Chinese.
I don't think that's true. I think there are a lot more young people learning Chinese now. The other thing China needs to do, and it's trying to do, is to make its currency more freely convertible.
What about its culture? You grew up in Hong Kong on jazz, on American television, Brady Bunch or whatever, and Catcher in the Rye. When are we going to start growing up on the staples of Chinese culture, popular or high?
Well, you know, my family was sort of a minority family in Hong Kong. We were Chinese Indonesian. My parents were not Cantonese speakers, per se. So we didn't grow up with as much Cantonese popular culture, but there was always Chinese popular culture as well. Certainly the Run Run Shaw films, all the Chinese films that were there, the Hong Kong film industry has always created a kind of cultural sort of heritage of its own. And also, growing up in Hong Kong, you do encounter the Chinese ribbon dance, you encounter Chinese opera, all of that is inescapable because it's there, and all the Chinese festivals. Now, the thing is, of course, we kind of got a bit away from that in Hong Kong because there was this, like, everybody wanted to learn all the, you know, sort of the MTV thing. Even Japanese culture became sort of more popular for young people, etc. But I've seen a return now to sort of traditional Chinese culture. But and that's good. I mean, I think it's a good thing for the kids to encounter that. But, you know, I wonder if that kind of cultural, which is a very surface thing, is like learn the ribbon dance. Okay, that's nice and all that. But what about its literature? What about its real heritage? That's still part of the problem with China, in that, you know, we have this whole cultural revolution, and there's a whole literature of that cultural revolution, which is still a little touchy. And as you know, there are Chinese writers who have left China and are writing about that, and they do it abroad rather than in China. Chinese writers still get jailed on a daily basis, intellectuals, etc. What about that? I mean, it's all very well to look at the sort of nice surface cultural safe things, even minority culture, you know, folk dances, costumes, etc. But what about what China is? China has a very confused, long history. I'm not so sure. For example, the study of Chinese literature hasn't sort of increased in Hong Kong. In fact, it's going down. Fewer students than ever are taking it, never mind English literature. And how deeply are our kids really schooled in Chinese art or Chinese ideas or all the philosophers over time, many of whom would be turning in their grave if they looked at what China was today.
Where do we begin on that course of learning Chinese culture the way you were schooled in Western culture?
I think, that's a difficult one because, you know, most people, for example, most people could say Charles Dickens, and even if they're not readers, will know that this is a great English novelist or English literature person, you know. You've heard of Shakespeare. But I dare say most of the world, unless they're actual Chinese sort of specialists or study Asian studies, probably don't know a great deal about Confucius or the great Chinese literature. I think among poets, they know sort of the Tang Dynasty and Song Dynasty poets, and Coal Mountain and things like that. But I would say that the sort of general knowledge about China's history, its culture, etc., is pretty low on the scale. You know, I can always tell because when I'm sort of introducing or giving readings or doing talks, etc., I always find myself, I can say Shakespeare, and it doesn't matter where the heck I am, everybody's heard of him, right? But I can't say the same thing about, you know, some major Chinese literary figure. And that's therein is the difference. There isn't that sort of cultural knowledge yet. I suppose the universities, in a way, in America actually have the seed of it, because there are plenty of excellent Chinese studies divisions in the various universities in the U.S. I'm not sure, I have no statistics on this, but I would venture a guess that there are probably more kids doing it these days, or at least studying Chinese and studying some of the Asian cultures. And really, that's where it begins. It begins in education.
Zhu Xi, it's been a great pleasure to read you, to meet you, to gab with you here at Calabash. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been fun.
Robert Pinsky writes poems of place, starting in New Jersey, melodic poems with palpable images that travel easily. He read his signature piece, Shirt, beginning the back, the yoke, the yardage, and the Calabash crowd would have listened all afternoon. Pinsky was the poet laureate who got thousands of Americans reading their favorite poems aloud. At Calabash, he heard scores of Jamaicans reading their own strong verses in open mic sessions. Robert Pinsky, favorite poet of the favorite poem movement, poet laureate and all that. You've done great for a white kid from Long Branch, New Jersey. The Jamaicans ate you up. Robert, I come to Jamaica for perspective on us and on the world. What does all this island, global, diasporic, enthusiastic, English language but universal head do with you?
I see in the cultural syncretism of the island, I see a rather promising vision of the next steps for American culture. Mm. One way to think of American culture is that we have this long project of becoming a people, and our great binary racial divide is only the most egregious example of that project of becoming a people. We are certainly a great nation. Our documents, our military power, our economic power, our constitution with the Bill of Rights, our legal system, it is a great nation. But we are perhaps not a great people. We have produced great works, the films of Buster Keaton, the poems of Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, the music of Duke Ellington. I think that project of making our hybrid nature, the multiple nature of American culture, a model I always have in mind is our music, our feature film. And in another way, a model not in art but in life is the best of Jamaican culture. And let's not sentimentalize it. This is a rather poor island. It has its own problems. Their educational system is not what it ought to be. There are lots of things that are problems. But their sitz flesh for poetry and music is dazzling. Mm. Just amazing to see, what is it, a couple of thousand people? In their...
Easy.
In those chairs, what do they call those white chairs? The rosin, plastic rosin chairs under a tent. We're sitting in our rosin chairs and we hear Marilyn Chin, we hear Selwyn Kudjoe, and then we hear the open mic, and there's still 1,500 or 2,000 people there for the open mic, and then for the music. And these are clearly people who are impatient with crap. They would not be sitting there if it was baloney. And they're hearing wonderful writing and wonderful music, and they know it. And they are, when you talk to them one at a time, they cheer you up.
Linger on the open mic, Robert. I thought it was so interesting. It went on and on and on. Young people talking about their first kiss or their first love or their father or their mother. All kinds of people. Older folk, too. The line never ended, in a way, of people ready to get up and testify in language, in a tradition. You're the people's poet. Nobody's drawn out the world of everybody in poetry as you have, Robert, but where do we see that?
I think these people have read a lot, I'm not sure what they've read. I suppose they have read Derek and other models from here. But like Derek, it's clear they read Shakespeare and Keats as well. Mm. And there's a kind of unabashed love, whatever evils the British Empire had, there's an unabashed love of the great English poets that I detect in the open mic people and in the audience, that people know what they're talking about. And I thought the open mic was very impressive for the quality of the writing. And the delivery was effective, but it was not the hambone delivery.
No.
It was superior to the most tedious forms of the poetry slam delivery, which are various forms of whining. It's exaggerated, not to make a blanket condemnation of it. But this was something else.
They have Marley to go by, too, let's remember.
That's right. And one of the things about the use of language that I've noticed here, and I've noticed before in the music, is no fear of abstractions. Mm. So to say, I had a confrontation with Robin Hood, was one lyric. No problem to use the word confrontation. And a refrain with a very, very engaging, sort of beguiling tune. The refrain has, it's a somewhat political song, professionals and leaders. Mm. When you take professionals and leaders out of the context of the song and the writing, it sounds like something in a boring PTA meeting. And in fact, it's made to be a very engaging chorus in that song.
Robert, Kwame Dawes especially was trying to tease out the cultural meaning of Barack Obama. What is the cue of this transnational United States president? I mean, the leader of the empire for artists and writers in the Caribbean. I don't think Kwame got an answer, but it's a great question. What do you take to be the meaning for artists of the Obama moment or the age of Obama?
One of the most moving passages in Dreams from My Father is the passage that deals with the stage in that boy's life when he has assimilated himself to Indonesian society. Mm. He's flying kites, he knows the language, he's accepted at school. And his mother, who has seen her husband Lolo diminished, frustrated, and ossified, he's a good man, but something is very wrong for him because he's living in a totalitarian country, she gets the boy up at 4:30 in the morning because she has realized she needs him to get an American education. He must be an American, in effect. And the kid is, it's 4:30 in the morning. The kid complains, he's sleepy. And she says, this is no picnic for me either, Buster. And her gift of that determination that he would know, he would have the Indonesian upbringing, he would know it, but in effect she wants him, and to me this is a great model for American art and American life, she wants him to be like Odysseus, the most interesting of the heroes. And in the first lines of the Odyssey, it says, Odysseus, though he failed to get his men home, Odysseus traveled many places and learned the manners of people in many different places. And this is the most interesting of the heroes. So he sees not just one way, but several ways. And she made sure that the sort of compass or core or guiding vision had to do with this project of being an American people. And when I read that extraordinary book of his, for me, that is one of the central themes, as he's very candid about his confusion, his postures. When he's very little, he lies about his father and the whole romance he makes with other kids about my father, the chief, I'll be a chief. How does he deal with various kinds of black American poses and postures and stereotypes? And he comes through it understanding many, many different things. And in those that first keynote address where he came to attention, it had to do with unifying, making something with integrity, some one thing out of all those many things. And I think that's an affinity between the president and where we are, and it's the beginning of an answer to Kwame's quite agree with you, quite pertinent question.
Robert Pinsky, great pleasure to see you here. It's a great pleasure to share your waves here on the south coast of Jamaica. Thank you.
My pleasure, and there's rarely been a setting better for the expression. My pleasure, Chris.
Thank you.
Finally, Kwame Dawes, a prime mover at Calabash, a man with a big question on his own mind. If the age of Obama really is what it feels like, a new time, a watershed for black, brown, and white people in the world, what is the opportunity, he wanted to know, the invitation for artists and writers like himself? Kwame Dawes was born in Ghana, schooled in Jamaica and Canada. He now teaches at the University of South Carolina. Kwame Dawes, you asked a question last night of several writers, and the question I thought was better than the answers you got. Broadly, it seemed to me you were asking for clues about where the culture goes in the age of Obama. A bigger blessing than one could have counted on this time a year ago. And I think you, on behalf of artists in general, were wondering, okay, how do we move in this moment? What is your own thought on that subject?
A couple of things that interest me about Obama. Some seem like trivia, and other things seem to be, I think, substantial. But I say seem like trivia when I think they are also substantial. And I'll put it this way. I wrote an inaugural poem for Obama. It was commissioned by the state newspaper in South Carolina. It's a long 8-part sonnet sequence. And it's called New Day. And in it, there's a sequence called On Having a Cool President. That's one of the sequences. There's another sequence that compares and connects Obama with Lincoln. In a sort of pivotal moment when Lincoln makes the series of compromises that would culminate in the Emancipation Declaration for the Southern states, of course, and how he uses that both as an expression of humanity, but also as a profoundly political gesture, and not just a political gesture, but an actual gesture of warfare. To secure a kind of victory by the emancipation of the slaves. And I thought of these two Illinois men and the way that they were walking into a new day, a new situation, and how are they going to deal with it. And I think Obama, for me, is interesting in that regard, and that race becomes engaged in that question from an ironic perspective, that Obama is now the beneficiary of what Lincoln did for all the reasons that he did it. Now, I begin that by saying that those two dimensions, one is, of course, the idea of a cool president, and there's, of course, the idea of the Obama as a person in a sort of new dispensation of understanding of self and understanding of culture and society, it seemed to me very important. Now, let me go back to the things that I call trivial and the things that I call substantial. A few trivial things. One is, I became a citizen of the United States in November of last year.
Oh, congratulations. Congratulations to all of us.
Yeah, I became a citizen after he won the election. I didn't get to vote, but I became a citizen then. And that is a remarkable thing to happen, because it's a choice that I made to do so. At first, it was a pragmatic choice, but then it became an interesting and complicated choice once Obama became president. Because it seemed to me that it opened the space for me to start to understand myself as an American in the context of an African American, in that genuine sense of a Ghanaian American, and to try and understand what that means. I call that trivial, but I call it substantial because there seems to be a sense in which I'm starting a journey along with this Obama guy, who I think, for all his African-Americanness, is a kind of immigrant in America, and I think understands the immigrant experience in that narrative. Second point of trivia, but I think is substantial, is there's a photograph that has been sort of floating around the internet, I suppose amongst literary-minded people, of a picture, if it's a picture of Obama with a volume of Derek Walcott's collected works in his hands. It was apparently given to him as a gift Now, I know Elizabeth Alexander, who did the inauguration poem.
Yes.
And she already had told me that this man actually reads poetry. And seeing that picture became an interesting thing because I thought, well, here's a guy who reads poetry and reads Derek Walcott, of all things. And this, to me, is incredibly fascinating. And it's fascinating because I'm a writer. And I'm not only a writer, but I'm an activist for poetry and for the fact that I believe that what poetry does and what art does to the human is that it gives us the capacity for empathy, because for me, the empathy becomes a function of the imagination. I think empathy is purely a function of the imagination, the capacity to imagine what another is feeling. And it gives me tremendous hope to think that this man, who I clearly think is smart, reads poetry and has some relationship to this concept of the imagination and this capacity, therefore, to empathize. Those are trivial things. Those are small things, but I think they're huge things. So couple that with the more substantial things of the fact that I think that Obama's journey towards being president means something more significant about America as a whole, and particularly white America, even beyond white America's sense of what it means. Because what actually has happened is that there's nothing particularly remarkable about black people voting for Obama. And I say that not because they would automatically vote for a black man, but they will vote for a black man who is able and skilled and gifted and a valid candidate. We can expect that, given those factors. As Chris Rock said, if it was Flavor Flav who was running for president, do they really think black people would vote for him? Absolutely not. So there's something substantial about the man that would make black people vote. But yes, it's not remarkable that African Americans and black people will vote for a man who is immensely qualified and is black. What is remarkable is that white people in America would forego their own anxieties and their own demons and their own sense of suspicion or guilt and their own sense of tradition and understanding of themselves and make this significant and dramatic thing. So for all those who speak of this as a triumph for the African American, it really is a triumph, as far as I'm concerned, for white America. This is the transformation. This is the dramatic thing that has happened. The capacity to then say, this man is going to be our leader. I think I understand that. That is a leap, a tremendous leap that has taken place. So given that substantial question, then I'm left with the idea that if it is possible for that idea to exist, then it means that I have to start rethinking or thinking carefully about my idea of audience and my idea of community. I don't think my idea of community has ever been so rigidly locked along racial lines, but this certainly gives me an opportunity to say that wherever that may have existed in some kind of invisible sort of line and barrier, it must be crumbled, because clearly those people who voted for the guy, for whatever reason, have to be part of my audience, because the audience now is changing. I think this is huge. You know, I think this is immensely fascinating, because I think that for an American to understand themselves to be led by an African American, it means that America, and particularly white America, I speak here specifically about white America, has to be engaged imaginatively with the idea of who this man is. And consequently, I become a beneficiary of that, because in a sense, while they engage with Obama, they must engage with me of who I am, and that we must find a point of connection and possibility. It's a moment. It's a moment. And it's a moment that we don't completely understand. But it's a significant moment, because the equations have begun to change. And I think that is the substantial way in which this is important to me. So trivia and substance, but altogether they become really crucial.
I love the way you put it. You're talking not about the people who are going to buy your books. You're talking about the people that a writer thinks about as his His people.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm speaking about the people who, the right, the people who I think of my people, the people who I think of who will read the work and who we will have the grounds for a conversation and an engagement and so on. And I've always had that experience that crosses racial lines, but I think this actually complicates it and actually opens it up in more interesting ways. And I think that's beautiful. So there's that level. There are other levels. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things that happened during the build up to the election, there was a great speech when he won during the primaries and he won South Carolina from Hillary. I was sitting with my son watching his speech after the primary and after he had won it. It was a really crucial moment because South Carolina is something like 40% African American, probably more. And it was clear already the McCain camp, and not the McCain camp, but the Hillary camp, had started to make sounds, sort of the notorious moment when Bill Clinton sort of made some passing comments and so on, but it started to make sounds that, oh, of course, South Carolina is not a big deal because it's a black state, and that it's automatic that he would win. And then the question then became, how does Obama embrace this victory without confirming exactly what the Clintons were sort of orchestrating as a line of argument? That he's won only because it's such a heavily black state. And he makes this speech that directly states that this is not about that. This is not about race. That this is about something more than that. And my son, who is sitting beside me, he's 15 years old, and we are watching this thing, and he turns to me and he says, "Man, Daddy, this guy is smart, man. Look what he just did," he says. And I am, at that moment, more fascinated by Kekele, my son's, ability to see the genius of Obama's rhetoric than even what Obama is doing. My son gets it right away that this man has worked his way through an interesting dilemma and created a whole new paradigm of understanding that is going to be transformative. And when he started to believe that, then I knew that something really important was taking place. Now, that to me is the kind of thing that really becomes important, because I think young people become engaged by those kinds of revelations that take place when they begin to see it happening. Because what Obama represents was somebody, for all of us, maybe not you, but certainly me, for somebody with a seemingly impossible obstacle before him to overcome. And all of us sitting down saying, we want him to get through this, but we ourselves don't have the answer for it. And then seeing him find the answer for it is an odd thing. At very few points have I ever, in the superficial way in which we have a relationship with national leaders, thought that George Bush would have a smarter way of doing something than I could come up with. This has never been something that I've ever sort of been flabbergasted by. But I have been by Obama in that sense.
You make a beautiful point that he has lifted us to a different expression, that it's a bigger, better audience for good thinking than we knew we were in. If I take you right.
You're taking me absolutely right. That's absolutely correct. It's, I think, in other words, the implications of Obama's victory, we haven't quite understood yet. But we know viscerally that something has happened. But we also know in some other specific ways that thing is happening. And Linton was right, and Van Peebles was right. Both of them said this thing. They said, it doesn't matter what happens next. Something has cracked in this moment. This is the great thing. It really doesn't matter what has happened there. Something has happened in the socio-political moment, in the geopolitics that has taken place. I think something quite dramatic has happened, and it does open up the idea of what a community looks like and feels like.
Kwame Dawes, thank you. Thank you for Calabash. Thank you for this conversation. And I can't wait to see it unfold.
Thank you very much. Nor can I.
Paul McCarthy edited these conversations with Kwame Dawes, Robert Pinsky, Sushi, and Melvin Van Peebles. Feedback with your own view, from near or far, on America and the world in the age of Obama, the human condition, and the cultural connection, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Wherever you're from, wherever you're at, thank you for joining us. That's what we want to make.